Oh no.
All right, awesome. Okay. Hello. Welcome to another episode of Oh No with Anna Campion. I'm Anna Campion, and this is my lovely guest today, Bea Peterson. Hello, Bea.
Morning. My name
Why
is Bea
don't
Peterson.
you Excellent. Bea, thank you so much for being on the podcast. This episode is going to be a little bit different than I normally record and post, but we are still going to be talking kind of about, I guess, something that's sort of like periphery to like embarrassing and crazy, which is a movie that is kind of embarrassing and crazy. But B, why don't you tell my captive audience a little bit about yourself?
All right, captive audience. My name is Bea Peterson, and I am technically a film critic, and this is what we're going to get to, as is Anna Campion,
This is true.
because I've been writing for a little site called Movie Babble for a couple months now, and I've been noticing that, like, hey, there's this other writer. It seems to be maybe the only other queer writer on the site that's been writing some of the best stuff on there, and I'm like,
Oh my God, stop it.
I'm. And anyway, and so I'm like, okay, I've got to follow this. I'm obligated to follow this person on Twitter. And then they just decided to start a podcast. And then I was like, okay, I'm going to listen to this podcast out of obligation. And then I started listening to it and I'm like, oh, this isn't normally what I listen to, but this is pretty great. And so I noticed though that there wasn't a whole ton of movie content, which was confusing to me because
No.
I only knew you through the film stuff and I knew that you had directed some short films and that you had gone to film school and I was like, so where's the
Film school's
film
a
content?
very, I didn't, technically, I was a film major. I was a film major in a very theory based, like I lied about going to film school, but to get a PA gig, but I didn't go. I didn't
All
go.
right. Okay.
I had no idea what the sticks were when I first. I mean, like I knew what they
You
were
mean
because like I saw them, but when someone was like, "Oh, well, you do sticks," and I'm like, "Yeah."
What?
I had no idea. But yeah, the podcast isn't really, I don't really talk a ton in, I guess, I mean, I do, I will say I had a friend of mine who was also a film major. He came on and we talked a lot about movies in that one, but I don't really post episodes that are like all about movies, like the one that we're gonna record right now.
All right. And don't get me wrong. I have I've I I rewatched the film that we're going to talk about last night and I took 5 pages of notes and a lot of that is that there is a lot that we can talk about regarding this film that would maybe be very a good segue or allow for tangents into embarrassing stories because I think this is something that there's a lot in this movie. This film that we're going to talk about is surprisingly one of the most controversial films of the year, which I did not expect from a Christmas rom-com.
No, I yeah, and we can kind of get into that, but yeah, we're gonna be talking about Happiest Season, the K-Stew Mackenzie Davis vehicle,
I'm sorry,
queer
K-Stew?
Kristen Stewart, K-Stew.
You call her K-Stew?
Yeah.
Oh,
Listen, I've
that's
been a K-Stew stan since 2008,
Oh,
baby.
wow. All
Yeah,
right.
Bella and Twilight. You kidding?
Okay. I've been a stan of her since Personal
She and
Chopper,
I
so
like
that's the kind of film person I am.
she and I had a very similar she and I like came out at the same time. Like we had a very similar sort of queer trajectory, she and I did. But I mean, so I guess what were your when you like heard about this movie first off, like what was your sort of initial first impression? Like before, like just kind of knowing like, oh, it's Kristen Stewart, Mackenzie Davis, and Clea DuVall like wrote and directed it. Like kind of what did you think off the bat?
When I first heard of Happiest Season, all I knew is that it was a Kristen Stewart movie, which, first of all, yes. Second of all, it was a Mackenzie Davis film. Okay, you have my attention. And then I heard that it was a lesbian Christmas film, and I'm like, oh, a Christmas movie that I may actually watch. And so that was really all I knew about it. I don't like knowing a whole ton about films before I go into them. And,
right.
And so I just kind of was waiting around for it to finally drop. And then it finally did. And it's actually kind of an interesting story, because I just sat down to watch it downstairs. I've got a projector and I just had it, just was watching it. And then my dad came into the room and is like, "What are you watching?" I'm like, "Oh, I'm watching a Christmas movie." And then, so I start watching the Christmas movie and he's like, "Are they gay?" And I'm like, "Yes." And then that turned into a whole thing, which we don't need to go into, but just like, it just occurred to me that like, if he had come down and seen me watching Call Me By Your Name or Bound or the Rocky Horror Picture Show, like that, I would understand that. It's like, whoa, this is very, very hum-a-hum-hum. But I was watching a PG-13 Christmas rom-com and he was still getting all in a huff about it.
It wasn't raunchy at all. It was very...
No, there actually is one moment towards the beginning where they have a... There's a little bit of slapstick physical comedy around, like, Kristen Stewart's falling off a house.
Yeah.
And the people in the house may be doing some naughty things or whatever. And that's just kind of... But it's just like a throwaway joke, and there's nothing else like that throughout the entire rest of the film.
Yeah, not at all.
And so I was just... Anyway, but as it turned out, it wasn't your typical rom-com, because this movie is a horror movie.
It was pretty dramatic. I mean, so what I should say is that I'm a huge fan of sort of the big three in this, which I'm a big Kristen Stewart fan. I'm a big Mackenzie Davis fan since San Junipero. I think she's awesome. And then I'm a huge Clea DuVall fan, because Clea DuVall's been on my radar for many a year now, since I discovered the seminal film But I'm a Cheerleader, you know, for those of you not familiar, you can watch it for free on YouTube. It's Natasha Lyonne, Clea DuVall, RuPaul is in it, the guy who voices Zuko is in it, and it's basically a very camp movie about conversion therapy camp, but it's a very like sort of lighthearted camp take on it, and sort of highlights the ridiculousness of everything, and it's great, and Clea DuVall is great in it. So when I first heard about this, I was like, God, it's like the universe went into my dreams and created something especially for me. And then I watched it with my girlfriend, and she and I were both kind of like, this is a little heavier than like we thought it was going to be. Like it wasn't quite as lighthearted as I think it was sort of advertised, and like the marketing sort of made it seem to be. And granted, like I knew that the premise was like, oh, closeted girl brings girlfriend home for holidays, chaos ensues. But the chaos wasn't as funny. It was a little bit more like, it was a little real.
Traumatic.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't know. And I mean, we can talk about this more at the end, but I do think that, like to start, I mean, you like the issue with like sort of, you know, queer filmmaking is that there's just not a ton of it. And when there is something like it, it's often very dramatic or tragic or a period piece or yada, yada, yada. Like there's a lot of there's not a ton of like queer films out there that have like a true like happy ending, like in the way that we would traditionally associate with like a romance where it's like, you know, a couple gets together and runs off into the sunset together. Like there's just not a ton like that. And so I think to have any sort of like sort of modern, like generally lighthearted queer movie is like a huge step in the right direction. Like, I think it's great. And I think the other thing is that, you know, Clea DuVall like wrote this and directed it because this is very much based on her life experience, you know? And so I think that, you know, it's something good to keep in mind that like art is personal. And like, I think that, I don't know. It's just, I don't know. We can get more into it, but I want to hear kind of like, you know, what you think.
Yeah, no, because this is an interesting film. my gel is falling off of my light, so I'm going to be a little blown out. All right. This is an interesting film, because what Clea Duvall here is doing is she's taking traditionally one of the most safe genres of film, which is the mm-hmm. Christmas rom-com, the holiday yeah. rom-com, which is always like the most fluffy, bland genre yeah. and filled with very, very simple farce and hijinks and coincidence and all that stuff. And she's injecting into it a very real, potentially traumatizing experience, which is mm-hmm. being forced into the closet and mm-hmm. and repression of identity and all of this stuff. And it's continuing to fall down. It's going mm-hmm. to fall on my head in a couple seconds.
Well, you can fix that if you need.
No, I'm enjoying this. I'm enjoying the tension. And the thing is what I think a lot of people have rejected is because of Clea Duvall is attempting to inject all of this stuff into the holiday rom-com, but still keep it the holiday rom-com, where at the end it is about happiness and forgiveness and love and the triumph of the holidays. And I think it works. I'm leaning on to the side of that this film achieves what it's setting out to do. And mm-hmm. yeah, why don't we just get into do you mind if we just like go through the film and just like talk out like all the beats of the film?
So all right, number one, I hated those illustrations at the beginning.
Like
I didn't I wish they were more cartoony or just like literal like Polaroids, you know?
Yeah, Polaroids might have been nice. That would have been cool. Maybe that's just because I'm on an instant film kick. But
yeah.
But I get the illustrations were pretty let's take a thing and rotoscope it and then soften all the edges type of deal. But I really liked what they did for the story, because what they did, if they hadn't done it, I don't think the film would have worked, because what they did is they showed an entire year of a relationship.
Yeah, no, I think it's good.
Which is important to establish.
Story. I wish that maybe, I don't know, maybe the intro is like, I wish it was more like snapshots mm-hmm. and maybe another 2 minutes of the film was dedicated like, but so what I wish is maybe that the beginning credits rather than like the snapshot, maybe if it was more like I don't know, maybe like iPhone videos or something mm-hmm. like of each other, you know, like I don't know, I feel like it would have been a little bit
I think it properly integrates you into the very holiday rom-com aesthetic, though, where mm-hmm. it is very like, it's very, very, I mean, it's not cheesy isn't the right word, but it's very fluff and
yeah.
and it puts you in the, I think, the right tone. But anyway, I think the most important part of the intro is that it shows them having a relationship, and it shows them having a relationship over an entire year
yeah.
that they had met like the previous, I think it was maybe New Year's mm-hmm. that they had met, and they had the first kiss at midnight on New Year's. And then it shows them having a relationship and spending the holidays with just the two of them and with the Dan Levy character mm-hmm. who, oh my word, Dan Levy. This is the first thing I'm seeing him. I don't know what the TV show that just ended that he Schitt's was in Creek. Or whatever. Yeah, it like swept the Emmys. I haven't seen a frame of that. I might now, because Dan Levy is amazing in this. Anyway.
And it's he's playing a very similar character.
Okay, cool. That's good to know. Mm-hmm. So we show them basically on this tour guide, who's the tour guide, by the way, is Michelle Buteau, I think is her name.
Yeah, she's hilarious. A stand-up comedian.
She's hilarious in this, and she's got like 30 seconds and mm-hmm. she's the best. I love her.
She had sort of like a similar bit part in the Gina Rodriguez rom-com with Brittany Snow and what's her face, where she played it was like a same, like she had like a 30 second scene with Gina Rodriguez.
Okay.
And she, you know, takes the cake, like she's awesome.
Gina Rodriguez is amazing. I think she was in Cajillionaire, right?
Yes,
that was her. Yeah, no, she was amazing in Cajillionaire.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. She's a good actor. But regardless, yeah, this I think sort of like this introduction, it also like sort of paints a good picture. I think it paints a good picture of like their relationship, and I think it also does a good job of like characterizing Harper a bit, like this idea of like getting really swept up in the moment and being like, oh, come home with me. And then like, you know, you realize like,
and then it cuts to the title, and then it cuts to the next morning when she's in like a super nice apartment. And well, she just like, oh no, what have I done?
Which is pretty a decently affordable place to live.
All right.
But
I'm just used to there it goes. See, there it is. There's my gel, my very professional gel over the light. And now it's sticking to the door. I can't with this. I just threw it at the door and it stuck. Anyway, and so and she wakes up and she's like, oh my word. And she comes down and Kristen Stewart is super hot making coffee. Mm-hmm. And there's all of a sudden all of these red flags where she's like, I don't know if you need to, and she's twisting her hair, and Kristen Stewart is just so into her, and just, and she's totally not reading all of the red flags, and the entire audience is like, oh no, what is going to happen?
And then
Kristen Stewart goes and gets a ring.
Mm-hmm.
And so first off, I have a question for you, Anna, as a homosexual, I don't know how true all of the stereotypes about lesbians wanting to get married after 5 minutes is. Like, what can you illuminate me on all that?
So I think that to a certain extent there is some truth in it, in that like the sort of relationships I've been in with women, it does move like more quickly than I find my like heterosexual friends like move in their relationships. But I think it comes from like a scarcity complex. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think, for a lot of queer people, and particularly those of the sapphic persuasion, I think that there is a, it seems like, and you know, this is all anecdotal. So like, but compared to, you know, my gay guy friends, they feel like they're operating in a place of abundance. And I think that lesbians feel like they're operating in a place of scarcity. Does that make sense?
Okay.
So it's like, I think that, and I say lesbians, I mean, sort of like sapphic, like, you know, this includes bisexual women and trans women, and, you know, all these, this isn't just, I'm not trying to just include like cis lesbians, but I do think there is a, I think that there is often kind of like a, I think if you couple in like the socialization of female friendships, and if you couple that with the very intense feelings that you have when you sort of realize that you're gay, and like you're kind of feeling all these feelings that your friends have been talking about and you've been kind of faking for a long time, I think that when you connect those two together, you're kind of like, well, okay, this is it. This is like what I'm supposed to do. And sometimes it's true and sometimes it's not. And so I do think that there is, I think that the timeline is a lot quicker, but I think, you know, sort of the U-Haul stuff, it is, you know, obviously it's a little bit exaggerated for, you know, everything, but I think that there is some truth in that. I think that, you know, it's kind of like you hear about, you know, like, oh my God, I met my, you hear about like, you know, girls who meet each other in the bathrooms of bars and stuff like that. It's like, and you know, they're like, I love you and you're so strong and you're so independent and you're amazing. And then you couple that with like attraction and it's like game over. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I think, but also, I mean, like you know, a year and a half or whatever of being together, 2 years, however long, like Kristen Stewart and Mackenzie Davis have been together in the context of this movie. Like, you know, a year and a half or 2 years together is like not an uncommon amount of time for like two adults to get married, you know, like even straight people.
Mm-hmm. I know plenty of heterosexuals who have decided to get married after a hop, skip, and a jump. And All right. So and by the way, Dan Levy is in this, and his whole energy is everything that, like, my word, where has this man been all of my life? Anyway,
I know, so he's awesome.
Yeah. And so we get into the car ride there, and they're almost there. And finally, Mackenzie Davis breaks the news. It's like, by the way, I'm not out to my parents, and they mm-hmm. think that you're my roommate. And mm-hmm. and it is a fine moment. But it's a very anxious moment. And Kristen Stewart does so much in that scene. We're just like all of the emotions going over her face, and just mm-hmm. be like, I hate this. I hate this. I hate this. I love you. I'm going to do this for you, but this better not go wrong.
Yeah.
And she's, Kristen Stewart is just honestly one of the best actors working today. And there's so much in this movie that proves that. But they show up to the house. And my first thought when we get to the house is like, oh, that's the literal house from Get Out. I don't know if it's, but it,
no, it's very similar vibes.
Same style house. And it's a very similar vibe. And I'm just like, oh dear. And then we meet the mother, and the mother is my least favorite human being ever. Like at one point, Dan Levy, just like when he finally enters the picture at the house and like she meets mm-hmm. the mom, he is like, who is she? She is fabulous. And I'm like, really? Really, Dan Levy? She's fabulous?
I don't
get it. I don't see it.
I think that there is often a certain admiration for, like, you know, middle-aged cold women men with homosexual tendencies, from what I've noticed. But I gotta say, I love all the actors in this, and I thought
the whole cast is amazing.
I thought it was great. And what I think the first few scenes, like at the house and sort of like what those do, I think it does a really good job of setting up the family dynamic and like why mm. Harper is how she is and why she is so scared to come out. Because, you know, like on the one hand, you're thinking like, oh, you know, this film takes, I think it's supposed to take place in like, you know, basically present time, like 2020 and maybe 2019. But regardless, it, you know, so you kind of go into it and maybe, you know, as a queer person, you're kind of like, oh, well, like, why are you so scared of coming out? Like, it's 2020, it's blah, blah, blah. But you kind of like see how the family's interacting with each other, and you see how the parents interact with the children, and sort of like how you can tell like immediately like what kind of family this was, and how it was a very like image obsessed family, and how that affected all three of the daughters, and particularly, you know, in our case, Harper, who, and why she feels such a pressure to, you know, to not necessarily, why she feels so much pressure to present as straight and to present as, you know, perfect, yada, yada, because like there's so much pressure put on her from her family.
And I think it is the sibling aspect that makes me lean towards this film working in the end, because if it had just been Harper that was like showing signs of repression, then I think this, and like the other siblings were fine or whatever, then I think that maybe you could have, the blame would have more been on Harper when everything goes wrong towards the end.
Yeah.
But since we see how, we see immediately how Jane, who is the MVP of this film, I love Jane. Mm-hmm. I'm forgetting the actor who played Alice. Jane.
Oh, Mary Holland.
Mary Holland. She co-wrote the script and she gave herself the best part, because Jane mm-hmm. is just the sweetest, most lovable person. And she is so put upon by this family.
Mm-hmm.
She is immediately shown to be, she's essentially the maid mm-hmm. in the eyes of the parents. And then when eventually we meet Brie Larson's character, Sloane, we see that
Allison Brie, not Brie Larson.
I always get those two people confused. Anyway, okay. I do the same thing with Chris Bode and Bill Conti, who did the score for Rocky.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, Alison Brie and the character of Sloane, and she is also repressed. And I think that that's what really shows that the mm-hmm. real problem in this film, it's not Harper, it's the repression coming from the parents.
Yeah, it is like a queer-based film. But
it is a queer-centric film,
but you can see that the sort of struggle isn't necessarily with Harper being gay or not gay or like whatever that, you know, it seems like the crux of the struggle doesn't lie in Harper coming out or not coming out. It actually seems like the crux of the struggle is more in the family than like in Kristen Stewart and Harper's relationship, which I think the misstep here is making Kristen Stewart sort of the main, most sympathetic character as opposed to Harper. Because I think like, because then, you know, you're watching this and you're sort of watching how Kristen Stewart is reacting to like, you know, being, you know, the orphan who's in a room that doesn't lock and stuff like that.
Everything with the orphan is just like, I'm so sorry, funny. Your parents are dead.
Yeah, I thought it was so funny. But like, I think then you're kind of like, oh, like, fuck you, Harper. Like, you know, especially, you know, film goes on. And there are moments when I think that's a justified reaction. But I think, I don't know, like as someone who has dated someone in Harper's position, and sort of like seen and sort of been in the K-Stew position, I think, you know, I think it would have behooved the film to make Harper, like give Harper a little bit more individual screen time than they did, because I think that probably would have, I don't know, been a little bit more, I think it would have made the audience in general more sympathetic to her. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I get that. And I think a large reason why I never really came down on her that hard is because I've been in Harper's situation. And I've actually, with the same person, I've also been in Kristen Stewart's position, where we've, like, both of us have at some point had to play it straight for each other's families. And I think the key thing is that when we went into those situations, we knew what we were going into, and we knew how the situation would be. And I think that that's where Harper's failing is. But since I know exactly what she's going through, and I know how tough this is, I didn't really need that extra screen time, because I kind of filled in the blanks. And I think that if you had added a ton more screen time just to give to Harper, I think that it might have affected the pacing.
I'm not saying a ton more, but I'm just saying like maybe an extra scene or two, you know?
Yeah, there's a moment where Harper's left. It's after when they're introducing the family and we get to Harper's room, and then it's like, oh no, why would, I'm not going to force two grown women to stay in a bed together. Oh my word. And then they leave to take Kristen Stewart down to the basement guest room.
Yeah. If they had like lingered there for a bit
was a moment where they had held for like half a second on Harper just alone in the room, just like, oh no, where she realized what this was going to be like. And I think if they had stayed with her for just a little bit longer, then that might have, anyway.
No, I agree.
I just wanted to point out that when we are introduced to the dad, played by Victor Garber, who is running for mayor, the film never out and out says that he's like a Republican or a conservative, but it's very clear throughout the film that they are a conservative family and all that jazz. But I just wanted to point out a little detail in the background that I caught in the second viewing, and that is in the background there is a vote for Caldwell sign for mayor or whatever, like there's a little campaign sign, and it is the exact format for the Trump Make It Keep America Great 2020.
Right. Yeah. So they're like, probably
it's the exact same thing with the stars and the color palette. And I'm just like, oh, okay. Thanks, Claire Duvall. I got it.
Yeah.
That was a great little subliminal thing. Just like, yes, this is a Republican household. And I think if you were to ask me, I think that that's probably where the biggest failing of the film was with the political aspect of just by trying to make it kind of vague and wishy-washy about what of the politics of the family. I think it makes I get what they're trying to do and I understand what they're trying to do. I just think that since so much of the film's backlash has been on Harper, I think if you had made it clearer about the politics of the family and what kind of policies that they were talking about. Mm-hmm. And I think it would have been more obvious that like, this is a conservative household and that that these parents are trying to show conservative values so that they can appeal to their base who is currently supporting 45.
Right.
Who, thank goodness. By the way, this is the most annoying thing I got to say about your podcast is that you have recorded so many episodes in advance. And so
I know, like, I don't know.
And
a lot so
I'm like, and I'm listening to an episode and I'm like, it's September 5th and Ruth Bader Ginsburg just died or whatever, like all this stuff. And I'm listening to this after the election has happened. I'm like, why are you taking me back to this incredibly stressful time?
I know. I'm sorry.
Anyway, that's just a nitpick, but it's just like every time I listen to like, what horrible thing is going on right now?
I'm running out of a back catalog, so it'll you know, get up to date soon. But doing a week by week recording is tough.
I want to get to talking about podcasts eventually, mm-hmm. just because I got questions.
Yeah.
Anyway, so why don't we jump ahead a little bit to mm-hmm. Let's talk about Jane's book. I want to talk about Jane's book for a hot sec. I just wanted to ask you, have you ever tried, because I feel like it's kind of like a rite of passage for someone who wants to get into writing is to mm-hmm. try and build a fantasy world.
Yes.
Have you ever done that?
Not really fantasy. It was more like, I don't know if you ever read these books, but there was like a sort of teen James Bond book series that I really liked when I was like 10 or 11. And I tried to sort of build a world based off that, and it was very hard. I don't think I've tried really properly since then. Like I have an idea for a Pride and Prejudice adaptation in a book form. But that world, since it's an adaptation, a lot of the world is already, the characters at least are built, and I just have to kind of like figure out the world that they live in. But regardless, it's really hard. It's like really hard mm-hmm. to do that.
I always get caught up in the minutia. Yeah, mm-hmm. It was just hilarious. Like all of the random names of the various species or whatever, mm-hmm. and it has a great payoff at the end. And anyway, mm-hmm. and I was just like the whole time she was talking about it, it was like, oh, I remember when I tried to write like fantasy worlds or whatever with stuff, and it all came off as so derivative and yeah. whatever. And anyway, the most recent aspect of this is I've made the entire outline. I technically just have to write it, but I did a version of Hamlet. Mm. I did a version of Hamlet where non-binary mermaids come and just fix Hamlet.
Oh,
they
nice.
They save Ophelia. They call out Hamlet and all his BS mm-hmm. and all this stuff, and they topple the monarchy and put in a socialist government. Like the whole thing, and right. over the course of the events of Hamlet, like they weave in and out, and it would use dialogue from various scenes or whatever. And it turns out, it turns out that Hamlet and Horatio were lovers at one point.
Of course.
And it's just like, anyway, I did this whole thing, and anyway, I still might get back around to that, but
we got nothing but time these days.
Queer AUs are like the number one thing for queer writers mm-hmm. is that everyone loves doing alternate universes.
Yeah, because this one hasn't been great to queer people, you know, so may as well make a different one. But I did think Jane was a really interesting dynamic character. I wish we'd spent a little bit more time with her, but I did really like her.
Mm-hmm.
I thought
we get to the dinner.
Mm. Oh, and this fucking boyfriend,
Connor, who
at was the, my high school up, boyfriend's name. Him. My high school boyfriend's name was Connor, but he is lovely.
Okay. The thing is, when he shows up, you hate him.
Mm-hmm.
But by the end of the movie, I kind of like sympathize
like,
for him.
Yeah, he seems fine.
He's fine.
He just seems like a guy who, and I mean, and what I will say is that like, I think that if I was in his position where like, you know, I had this, you know, high school significant other who I really, really liked, and they kind of broke up with me out of the blue, and I kind of never got answers on it. And like, you know, according to her family, like she's still into me and she's still single or whatever. Like I can see why he would still hold a torch for her. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like it makes sense.
I mean, it's Mackenzie Davis after all.
Gorgeous. So yeah, I didn't hate him by the end of it. I thought the choice of giving Kristen Stewart a very short chair was awesome. at that dinner table. I thought it was really funny. And then, of course, we meet Riley, Aubrey Plaza.
Whew. Aubrey Plaza. Oh, my word. Mm-hmm.
She is something
else. Every single time she shows up, I'm just like, oh, hello.
Okay, and I'm going to say something controversial. I completely disagree with the Abby Riley getting together at the end discourse.
Oh, yeah. No, I completely disagree. I don't think that would have worked. I think that they were just kind of thrown together through this one very difficult moment in time, and I don't know.
They were friends. Like, I think,
yeah, like, I think that was great.
You know, there was a moment where I was like, oh, are they kind of angling for this? Like, that would be kind of a bummer. Like, I do think they had chemistry together, you know, like, I think, mm-hmm. like, I would buy it, you know, if that had happened. But I think that, like, you know, again, as someone who has been in the Abby position here, I think that when you're going through something like this and you're kind of, you feel like you're in like the middle of a heartbreak, you know what I mean? And you're like really uncertain if it's going to turn out okay. I think that having like a friend who is also gay, like, and who like can sort of empathize with this, and obviously Riley can empathize with it in a huge way. Like, I think that that is more important than like a potential romantic partner. You know what I mean? Like, I think it's really important to have someone who is like not trying to get into your pants and just like genuinely is just like, the situation sucks, you know?
Yeah, it's something that I noticed while watching this movie is like with the Dan Levy and with the Aubrey Plaza characters is that gay best friends feel so much more natural and feel mm-hmm. like such better characters when they're friends with gay people.
Yeah.
Because like the straight best friend character, when it's like with a heterosexual, like if when the stars are straight, it just feels, I don't know, it feels like a token thing. And mm-hmm. and very stereotypical, and just having gay people talk to each other and not be into each other, I just felt mm-hmm. was really nice. I have to say though, that I think that there is in the text of the film that there are moments where I think Riley is not like making a move on Abby, on Kristen Stewart, but there's a specific moment when they're in a bar
mm-hmm.
and like, it's this very nice moment and they've had this nice heart to heart. And there's a moment where like things are like the drag queens are singing their song mm-hmm. and it's a very subtle thing that you might not even notice, but Aubrey Plaza switches mm-hmm. to her side of the bar and just kind of slouches down, like getting comfortable. And like, mm-hmm. I've done that exact same thing. Mm-hmm. And like, Riley is clearly, I think, reaching out in that moment, like just mm-hmm. like, maybe this can work. And then of course, Mackenzie Davis is like, come hang out with my friends in a very different, which by the way, I have never been in a bar. I'm not interested in alcohol. I'm 19, so that's like the law, but mm-hmm. I also just don't care.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I'm going to drink when the time comes either. Is that what bars are like? Are bars like that?
You know, it depends on what the bar you go to is. I love bars. So like, I think the drag queen bar, in terms of like the energy, I found to be, and granted, I also, this takes place in like a small town in Pennsylvania. And the majority of the bars I've gone to were either in Williamsburg, Virginia, where I went to college, or in New York, where I live. And so, but I think the energy of like the drag queen bar was a lot, it seemed a lot more realistic than the energy of like the sports bar or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But I have been to bars where, like kind of like the sports bar, where I'm just kind of standing there and I'm like, I don't like the energy in here. Like, this is not.
It was very, very aggressive. Whole vibe.
Yeah. But so we meet Riley and Connor at the dinner. And you know, Connor's like, oh, I really want to hang out again, blah, blah, blah. And Harper and Abby have that nice moment in the bathroom, and then, you know, all this stuff. And then this is kind of like everything starts going downhill. Like, nothing really good happens to Abby after this, because you have that, like the big, like fundraising dinner or whatever. And like that, and, you know, it also became very apparent that Sloan had picked up on this pretty quick.
Yeah. There was a moment during Victor Garber's speech, when he's like mm-hmm. giving the speech or whatever, when Abby and Harper like have this very incognito handhold moment mm-hmm. and something else that I have done. And
Sloan like notices sort of the aftermath of that. But even before mm-hmm. that, it's like when, you know, she and Kristen Stewart are in line to get food, and it's like, oh yeah, like I moved into her place, and Sloan's like, oh, I thought that was like a one bedroom. It's you know, oh no.
Kristen Stewart's line is like, there's a line towards the beginning. It's like, please don't lie because you're terrible at lying. Mm-hmm. And Kristen Stewart lies so terribly and so mm-hmm. beautifully. And she's just like, yes, my boyfriend, I just went through a breakup. He was a milkman.
Yeah.
And just like,
yeah.
Like all of her lies throughout the entirety of this film is like, I just sleep in the pantry or whatever.
It's very, very funny. It's very funny.
And I think what the dinner, the big gala thing event scene proves to me is that the best rom-coms, I think, is you can tell when a rom-com is really, really great when all of the characters, no matter who, like how much screen time or how many lines they have, are memorable. And I think that's best exemplified with Sherilyn's assistant named Levi.
Mm-hmm.
He's got one line in this entire film, and he sells it beautifully. And it's just like, I want to see a movie about that guy, because he's like, oh yeah, someday we'll all be working for him. He's like, oh, you're too kind. And then his face just drops
soon
as she looks away. And it's just like, I want to know everything.
No, I think, I think all the characters in this are written really well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, regardless of sort of how your feelings on Harper are, like, I do think that they succeeded in making her a very complex character and sort of someone who, you know, like I didn't find anyone in this film to be two-dimensional, you know, which I think mm-hmm. is cool.
Except for maybe the high school friends, those two high school friends that were there. They're just
But even then, it's like you have the one who, it's like even then you can see in their dynamic, there's like the one who's like, ooh, like Connor and
I would sleep with him.
Are totally gonna bang tonight. And the other friend's like, if she doesn't, I will. No. Like you can, and even in that little interaction, you can see so much about what their dynamic was in high school, where it was like Harper was sort of like the beautiful, unattainable one. The other friend was like very comfortable in her own skin, very happy being, you know, with the attention she got. And then the third one is like deeply insecure to this day. And like, you can see that whole dynamic play out in, again, and just like a minute and a half of screen time. So I think it's really good.
Dan Levy has a Kristen Stewart calls Dan Levy mm-hmm. and Dan Levy gives the best line of the entire film, which is that, I'm not shaming you. I'm just saying this decision is dumb and you should feel bad about it and yourself.
Yes.
And he has so many great lines of this, where like when she asks about the fish, when Kristen Stewart mm-hmm. calls to ask about the pets or whatever, and he's like, the fish are yes. And
yeah,
just like so many throwaway lines. And yeah, I'm going to have to watch this show with him just so that I can get more of him. The next day they go, well, first of all, there's a whole shenanigans with trying to get downstairs to Harper's, or getting upstairs to Harper's room.
Classic rom-com, very funny.
Yeah. And she gets in the, like, what are you doing in the closet? And mm-hmm. just like, so in the Roomba and all that jazz. And then of course Harper ends up down in the basement room, and mm-hmm. then they accidentally fall asleep together. And then the kids, mm-hmm. the twins, see him in the morning, and then they go shopping with the twins. And by the way, this was the most, who are these children? These little children.
So anxiety inducing.
You talked in the last episode that was released about how you babysat for like a summer these two kids that you thought were super weird or whatever, because mm-hmm. they didn't listen to music or didn't watch
those
TV.
Those kids were nicer than these kids. But sort of same like.
Mm-hmm. I just want to say that I was one of those kids. I never listened to music. I never watched TV. I like to read. I'm sorry, Anna.
That's weird, dude. That's weird that you never listen to music. That's weird.
It's not that I never listen to music. It's that I never sought out listening to music because I just like to read.
Weird.
The day finally came where I listened to my dad's greatest hits of Queen, and from then on I listened to music.
And then you turned gay. And then you turned queer.
Then I went queer. Yeah.
I'm sorry. That's weird.
Whatever. Fine. Yeah. I mean, it's not like I have a problem being called weird. I've never been normal, but I felt just a tiny bit attacked when
I'm glad you felt attacked because I was attacking you because I think it's
okay.
Weird. I think
good
it's,
to know. Here's but the thing. I want to say that I'm not as weird as the kids in the film because another amazing line is when Sloane's like, I'm going to have to leave the kids with you because Santa promised them the complete works of Sylvia Plath.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm like, who are these 10-year-old children?
So like morbid.
Sylvia
so macabre.
Plath.
Yeah, no, these kids are trouble. And then they, you know, they plant the necklace on her in front of, and you know, in front of the
campaign assistant.
The dinner and yeah. And then she's, and,
these the security guard.
Awesome. So Lauren Lapkus was the gal, and she's hilarious. She's so awesome.
And then the guy was the headmaster or the principal or whatever from the TV miniseries Looking for Alaska, and he was great in that.
Interesting. Okay.
And he does a complete comedic turn here, and that's lovely. And anyway, all the little bits are great.
And then I just felt so bad because like the whole family thinks that she like stole a necklace. And she's like, I didn't. And that just sucks. Like, it's just like, she's like, I'm actually not lying this time. Like, I didn't do it, I promise. And just like, no one believes her. And then she's like left alone. She meets up with Riley. The whole sort of bar scene that we were talking about happens. And then this is when Harper sort of has a turn I was really worried. I was really worried here. Because when, you know, Kristen Stewart leaves the bar and she's like, I'm going to go home. And then she's like, oh, well, I'm going to stay for a bit. And she and Connor have that like moment. I was so worried that they were going to kiss or something.
Oh, yeah.
I'm so glad they didn't.
If they had, I think that would have made me lose sympathy. I have no idea why she would have done that.
No, what I was expecting is like, maybe he like goes in for a kiss and she like pushes him away or something like that. And there's like a sort of confrontation there. But I'm glad that it was like friend vibes. But then, you know, the next morning.
Yeah, no, they were just being honest with each other.
Yeah. But then
Harper was willing to be.
Yeah. When Harper's like, oh, well, you're, you know, suffocating me, like whatever. Then I was kind of like, all right, okay, Stu, you gotta go. You gotta get out of here.
Get out of this. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that Kristen Stewart in that scene where it's the where Harper yells, it's just like, I'm not hiding you, I'm hiding me.
Mm-hmm.
And while yes, she is hiding herself, and that is where her that is traumatic for her, it's her unwillingness to acknowledge that she is also hurting. Yeah. Abby in that scene is just like, come on Harper, do you not see what you're doing?
Yeah, you gotta admit
and,
both sides.
And Kristen Stewart is just giving us so much, like her eyes and her biting her lip, like it's her signature thing, and every time she does it I'm just like, thank you, I got another one.
And then she, you know, she meets up with Riley again, gets like the white elephant gift,
and then finally the Christmas Eve party happens.
Whew.
And Dan Levy shows up and he gives his heterosexual ex-boyfriend voice, which is the best thing. Or just like,
very funny.
Hello.
Yes.
I have come to get her back.
And and
then his interaction with Connor, where he's just like, oh, you pump?
Yeah.
He's like, you pump? Oh, wow. It's like 1,000+. Yeah.
I thought that was really funny. I also, again, it's like, I really like these scenes in the house with the whole family, because again, I really do think it gives an insight into why Harper is the way she is. And I thought it was a genius thing to include the detail of Sloane trying to hide the fact that she's getting a divorce. and that her husband is hooking up with, you know, the campaign manager or whatever in the closet.
And it's not like that's like a surprise, like, you're cheating on me, I can't believe it. It's that I trusted you to have some boundaries,
you know,
until we told
pants.
People.
Yeah,
it's just, I like that moment wasn't I can't believe you're doing this to me. It's more like, come on, we talked about this.
Yeah, it's like a different kind of revelation. And I think that, like, including that, again, it focuses the film less on Harper and Abby and their struggles and more on, like, Harper's struggles with her family and, like, how that has translated not only for her and her keeping, you know, her love life a secret and all that stuff, but, like, her, you know, her sister feeling that, like, she can't even be honest about the fact that she's getting a divorce, or that she's going through marital issues with her family. So, yeah,
Jane doesn't even have the willingness to speak up for herself. Like,
yeah.
she can't feel like she can even talk about her, what she likes. Like, there's this repression all around. And then, of course, the big confrontation happens, and Sloan outs Harper, deeply terrible thing to do.
So awful. That was nearly unforgivable. And what I will say is Sloan sort of walking in on them making out, what I wish it had been, I mean, I understand that the confrontation needed to happen the way it did, because one, it's a comedy, and so you need it to kind of be funny, and you need to kind of have this huge revelation to sort of spark everything else. But I think that, I just don't know if that is realistic. Like, I don't know. I feel like, it just goes to show how, like, toxic this family dynamic is, where, like, she feels like now she has, like, ammo on Harper that she can use to sort of get back into the number one slot in her parents' good graces, which is awful. Like, what an awful thing.
But
this is right after Abby has said, like, you know, this is the last straw, it's over, I'm done, goodbye. And, you know, Harper's, like, pleading to get her back, and she can't focus on, you know, making sure that Abby's okay and Abby's staying, because her sister's about to out her. So, like, you kind of get into a really anxious headspace for Harper, because, like, I mean, coming out is terrifying, and it's really awful when you're not the one doing it, when you're getting outed. That's horrible.
I've been outed, and it really is. If it doesn't go well, but even if it does go well, it's still just a really, really just terrifying and traumatic thing that happens. It's just like, where you are putting yourself out there in a way that will either could possibly make people completely shut you out of their lives. And for that decision to not be yours is a terrible, terrible thing. And so I feel for Harper, because I know that trauma. And she does it because of how repressed she is, and because of how her family is, as how she's been brought up. But then by denying it,
that hurt, because it's like,
that's the point of the scene, but it hurts. It really, really hurts.
Well,
totally understand why Kristen Stewart just gets out.
Yeah, and I think in that moment, I understood why Kristen Stewart got out, and I also understood why Harper was just, like, denying it and was just, like, you know, praying that everyone would believe her over her sister, you know. And it's like, you know, like, to be caught in a lie like that is so embarrassing, and not only to be, I mean, it was one thing to be caught in a lie about, like, you know, no, I didn't do my homework, but, like, it's another thing to be caught in a lie about, like, your life and your identity, you know what I mean? And, like, sort of how, and, you know, not that I don't want to equate, like, not coming out with lying, because I think, you know, different situations demand different measures taken for, you know, safety, comfort, you know, whatever. I would never want to equate the two, but the fact that she, you know, has been omitting the truth about this, her identity, and is sort of caught in that and is just like desperately trying to like get out of the hole that Sloane just tossed her into is, it's a terrible feeling. It's awful. It hurts, you know, it hurts to watch.
Yeah. And then, and it leads to a very, very good moment where after the guests leave and Victor Garber's like, what has happened here? I can't believe that you've done this to me.
Mm-hmm.
And Harper's just like, no, I am gay. And she does say it, which good for her. And then Sloane comes out like, and I'm getting a divorce.
Mm-hmm.
And then Jane goes is like, I don't have any secrets, but I am an ally. And yeah, it just, and everyone loves Jane. Jane is the best. And, and I think that Kristen Stewart has the appropriate reaction where it's like, where Harper's like, I love you. And Kristen Stewart is like, I'm sorry, but I need to get out of this right now.
Yeah.
And she leaves with Dan Levy. And that leads to the most important scene in the film, which is Dan Levy's speech, which I feel like all of the people who are hating Harper, like this, I think that this speech is the counter to that. And it's in the text. So I think that this is why I think the film works in that regard, is because this is, everyone's story is different. Abby, you had an amazing experience coming out where your parents supported you. And I didn't. I was kicked out of the house and my father didn't speak to me for 13 years.
Mm-hmm.
And Harper is somewhere in between that. And so we have to understand that coming out really is, it is a potentially traumatic experience for everyone. And
And there's so much truth in that bit that he said about like Harper not coming out has nothing to do with her love for you. Like that it is, the two are totally unrelated. And when you're in the Abby position, it's so hard to see that, but it's 100% true, where it's like it doesn't matter how much she loves you. And you know, she obviously loves you a lot, but like it does not matter if, because coming out is so personal, like it's so only about you, you know what I mean? So I think it works really well, you know, and sort of, I think it also, again, it really helps sort of to allow people who were anti-Harper to sort of start to sympathize with her, you know?
Yeah. And then comes the scene that so many people hate, where they basically, Kristen Stewart forgives Harper and is like weak, and like Dan Levy like gives her the nod, is like, hey, she loves you.
Mm-hmm.
And they have their big romantic kiss.
Mm-hmm.
And I get why people rejected that moment, and it does feel a little not cheap, but like chintzy. And then I have to remember that this is a holiday film. Like this
and
is
it's
about
a romantic comedy.
It's a romantic comedy, and it's a movie about, it's centered around Christmas and centered around family and forgiveness and holiday spirit and all that jazz. And I think that by putting it in that context, I think that the writing has been good enough up to this point, and that the selection of genre is very, very specific and intentional. And I think that that moment is earned. I think the moment that isn't earned is the one following that. But what were you going to say?
Yeah. But I mean, you look at, you know, sort of classics in the romantic comedy genre, like How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days, Made in Manhattan, like, you know, sort of like 27 Dresses. And like, you look at those, and those all have the same structure as this film, like realistically speaking. Like there is, at some point, there is a lie, there is deception, there is some sort of obstacle that gets in the way of, you know, Kate Hudson and Matthew McConaughey being together. And there is always forgiveness in there. You know what I mean? Like, there's always like a point when, you know, it's okay that, you know, you only just broke off your engagement. It's okay that you were just dating me to write an article. It's okay that you asked me to the dance on a bet. Like, there is always that sort of forgiveness there. And I think that if you, you know, if you buy into those, then I think you have to buy into this. You know what I mean?
See, actually, yeah, yes. If you buy into those, then you have to buy into this. I actually think that this film works better than those films, though, because in those films, the entirety of the relationship is based in a deception.
Yeah.
And here, they've had an entire year of a good relationship and a strong relationship. And it has only been these 5 days, this short period of time, this one admittedly very, very traumatic experience for both of them. It is testing their relationship. And I think that if at the end of that, there's like, hey, we definitely have some stuff to work out, but I'm willing to go the distance with you. I think that that is earned.
I agree.
And so if Harper had been lying from the get go or whatever, and like Kristen Stewart had been going through this the whole time, then obviously get out. But they had an entire year of being together and building a life together.
A clearly very strong and loving relationship.
And so I think that you can endure this traumatic experience. And if Kristen Stewart needs time, then okay, that's completely valid. But if she's willing to give it a go, then that is also completely valid.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. So I think that I think you're totally right. I think you're 100% right. I agree. I think the subsequent scene when, you know, it's Christmas morning and, you know, the dad is, you know, suddenly okay with everything and is like, well, I'm going to need some time, but blah, blah, blah. That's where it's kind of like, okay.
Yeah. So
that's where you kind of have to cut it a little slack because it is like a holiday film, you know, like if this was not a Christmas movie or like a holiday movie, I probably wouldn't cut it as much slack, but considering that, you know, again, it's Christmas morning, it's the theme of forgiveness and family and blah, blah, blah. It like, I can kind of let it slide. You know what I mean? Like, it's kind of like, okay, like, you know, again, if you're going to buy into the holiday romantic comedy, you got to buy into all of it.
Yeah. It's just like having, like just watching the scene where like, if your daughter can adopt a don't ask, don't tell policy or whatever with the donor, the big donor. And Victor Garber is like, I guess we'll have to work something else out or whatever. And it's just like, okay, so he's being Dick Cheney now. And and it's just like, but the thing is I still don't like Dick Cheney. Just because he loves his gay daughter doesn't mean that he's a good politician. He's one of the worst.
Yeah. And so, I think it's probably good that they didn't make him an out and out Republican. Like, it's possible that maybe he's like, you know, a centrist Dem or a centrist Republican, you know what I mean? Like, I think that's probably what they were kind of going for. Like, I think this sort of like Obama Biden type, like all Americans are valuable and reaching out and blah, 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 with like, you know, some sort of more traditional conservative, like family values. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I just think that like, there's like in his moment speeches, like we have to root out the cracks in our society. Make sure there are no cracks, that everything is picture perfect. And like all that stuff is just like, I don't know. The political aspect, I think, was the weakest aspect of the film for me. And just like the whole aspect of like, we're just going to kind of let the parents off the hook. And then we see there's the epilogue where Jane has published her book through Dan Levy, who was a book agent or whatever. And like happy, there's a super happy ending. They're engaged. And then we get, I think the film that, okay, you can't pay attention to the social media posts. That scroll through the credits, because if you look at the dates, it says that this Christmas that we just watched happened in 2020, which no, it didn't. There was not a huge party. And it, but if there was, it would have been a very conservative party because like they're the people who aren't, who are just going to be hanging out, who cares about masks or social distancing.
Well, I think
obviously this film couldn't have predicted the pandemic, except there was a moment in the maybe about halfway through the film where the mom was talking about, was like, you need to make Christmas cookies this, or you need to go to the mall to see Santa, because this might be your last chance to do that. And I think she was talking about,
I think she was talking about one before Christmas. And also I think the kids are like 10 or 11. So they might like not believe in Santa next year. Like they're kind of at that age where they like, you know.
But when I first saw that, I was like, does she know that there's a pandemic coming? And
I mean, of course, you know, you
like, was that
obviously,
just, was that line just put in there and ad lib in dubbing or whatever to foreshadow? But like, anyway, and we do see that they were engaged, and in the social media scroll, we do see that Harper and Abby got engaged in October. So it's not like they got engaged in January right after all this happened. It was another 9 months before.
Yeah.
So they had been together for a total of like 20, 21 months before they got engaged, and they had a good relationship, and then they went through a traumatic experience, and then after 9 months of more work, they tied the knot. And I think that I think that the film earns it. And if you don't, then I see where you're coming from. I just think that the writing is too good. Also, in the social media scroll, they're at a pride, like our first pride or whatever, in like June 26, 2021 or whatever.
Yeah, like it kind of adds up that, you know, I think what I will say is that I think there are a lot of parents out there of, you know, of queer children who I do think like get informed, you know, like I do think, you know, obviously there are, you know, parents who are not accepting and who, you know, of course that, and that sucks. And I hate that that is true. And, you know, I was very lucky where my parents, you know, have always been pretty liberal, pretty, you know, pretty accepting. So when I came out, it wasn't a really big deal. But I do think there is a genre of parent that I think, like maybe in the film timeline, they don't earn it. But if we're kind of going through these like social media posts that show like the year after, I think there is a bit of earning it there, where they're like, I love my child so much, and I am going to do my best to make sure that I can keep my child in my life. And I think there is a genre of parent that will often, like, you know, sort of throw away their, you know, quote unquote conservative family values in order to keep a relationship with their child, which is great. And which is, I think, the sort of direction that these parents, you know, are going in, you know?
Yeah. I just wanted to point out that at the Pride Parade, like, we see the family, the whole family's there, and Dan Levy's there, and Aubrey Plaza's there. Did you notice who was with Aubrey Plaza?
No.
It was Clea DuVall.
Oh.
She made a cameo, the one image. She was just right there. The second time through, I was like,
That's awesome.
Clea DuVall. And so she has a cameo of a 5-second cameo in a single Instagram post, which, and there's a moment where, like, there's a running gag throughout the film that, that the mom is trying to get the family photo.
Yeah.
And at one point she's taking photos of them and she's like, this is great content. And I'm like, What kind of a world are we living in now? It's just like everything is about content. One of the worst words in the English language.
Yeah. Yeah. Content creation is a curse. I mean, I don't know. Like, I think I understand where the critics are coming from, and I do understand why this could be triggering for a lot of people.
Definitely.
But it's such a double-edged sword with queer content, you know, because on the one hand, it's like, I would love to watch a movie where no one has to come out.
That isn't the
that is that is not the reality that most queer people have lived in. You know what I mean? It's like, I don't think we're there yet is kind of the tragic thing. And you know what, and you know, maybe the next stage of this is like, oh, there's a romantic comedy where, you know, everyone's already out and, you know, there's a different conflict. But I think that like for so many queer people, coming out is kind of the big obstacle. And everything else feels like such small potatoes in comparison, you know, in terms of your romantic relationships and your relationship with your family and your friendships. And so like, you know, if you know, you're kind of looking back on your life and doing, and you're a screenwriter and you're kind of doing like a write what you know sort of thing. And you're kind of like, okay, well, what was the biggest problem in my last relationship? That my partner wasn't out. That was the biggest problem. Like, you know what I mean? Like everything seems so negligible in comparison to that, you know, like it just, so that it kind of, it makes sense why, you know, we still have movies where people have to come out, because people still have to come out in real life. Like that's the world we live in, you know?
Mm-hmm. And I just, and yeah, and I think that the way that I ended up viewing this film, which was I had it set up on my projector and I was going to watch it. And then my dad came in and it became a whole argument.
Mm-hmm.
And I ended up having to watch that movie on my laptop alone in my room.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just like, we still live in a world where these stories are have to be fought for.
Mm-hmm.
because people still are still thrown by even the idea of a PG-13 fluffy Christmas rom-com, even though this one turned out to be not just fluff, that there is a lot of stuff that it deals with, but even with just like a PG-13 Christmas rom-com, that still is like, oh my word, I can't believe that that you're exposing yourself to this kind of stuff. And just, I think that this movie is honestly one of the better films of the year. And I was just really, really happy that it came together the way it did, and that it's at least being talked about the way it is.
Mm-hmm.
Because regardless of whether you buy it or not, by the ending, that this is a win, I think. Mm-hmm. in terms of representation. Well, and in terms of normalizing storytelling.
I think, you know, Hulu released a stat that this was like the number one original movie they've ever released, and it brought in the most like new subscribers for it ever, which is crazy. I mean, that's awesome, you know? And so to have, I guess, you know, it's hard because on the one hand, you know, of course I want more queer movies and TV shows and music and everything and books and, you know, any kind of media. Of course I do. And also, everyone has a right to criticize anything, you know, that's what we do.
Everyone's
in our free
a critic.
Time. Everyone's a critic. So I get it. But I do think that, and you know, I would never want to say like, shut up and be grateful. Like you should be grateful that this is even being told, because I don't think that that's a healthy mindset. But I do think that at a certain point, I think that because you didn't enjoy it the way that you thought you would, that doesn't mean it's not valuable to someone else. So I think I'm glad that there's a lot of conversation about it. I'm glad that people feel like they're safe enough to sort of say like, I found this triggering, I found this traumatizing, I didn't enjoy it. And I obviously would never want to silence them, but I think that for a lot of people, it is kind of nice to just see like a queer couple that works out, and I get it that like, you know, maybe the film didn't earn like the family's, you know, acceptance, but like
on the turn of a dime. Yeah.
But you know, it was also, you know, I don't think the film earned Luke and Leia being brother and sister at the end after they kissed. You know what I mean? Like, I think that, like,
I don't care about Star Wars.
No, but I'm just saying, it's like, I think that I wish that there was a little more nuance and there was a little bit more in the conversation. I wish there was more some more insight into, like, okay, well, why did Clea Duvall feel the need to tell this story? And like, mm-hmm. what does that look like? Cause, like, you know, you think about it, she's 45, 50, somewhere in there. So, you know, she was in her 20s in, you know, the 90s and early 2000s. And she was like very early, like doing, you know, sort of gay, queer media. And that's like fucking hard. Like that's crazy. Like she was like in queer media at the same time that like Ellen came out on her, you know, on her sitcom.
Yeah. And everyone has issues with Ellen now, but I mean, back in the day,
Ellen did back in the day. She's awful now. Because she's a billionaire, but in
billionaires shouldn't exist.
Correct. But you can't deny what she did at the time. But I guess my point being that, like, Clea Duvall was out and sort of doing the work of representation, like way before it, you know, way before Orange is the New Black, The Haunting of Bly Manor, Sense8, like, you know, like way before it was, you know, before fucking DOMA, you know? So.
Yeah. And it's not like she's a terrible person now or anything. It's just that she's telling a story. It's she's telling a story that certain people are getting tired of seeing. And I get it. I get why, but it's still a valid experience. And as long as Clea Duvall is being honest and being authentic in her storytelling and is listening to people, and I think that's a victory. And
mm-hmm. I agree.
Yeah. So happiest season. You were a happy experience. I mean, you were a traumatizing experience to watch, but like it was a great, great film, great characters. Yeah, I want to see Aubrey Plaza and Dan Levy and everything.
Yeah. I genuinely enjoyed it. I thought it was cute. Straight up.
Yeah,
I
just
thought it was a cute movie.
Yeah.
And I think I understand why it's getting a lot of heat, but I don't necessarily think all of it is deserved. Okay. So that about does it.
All right.
But what plug away.
All right. So first of all, you can find me on Twitter at Blue Gray Closet. You can find me on Letterboxd at Blue Gray Closet. I write at Movie Babble. I've stopped publishing articles in the last couple of weeks just because I'm working on this podcast and trying to figure everything out with that. But I've done.
Oh, I only do like one a month.
Yeah. See, what kind of broke me is that I published 8,000 words in a week.
Yeah.
I had two articles on Quibi. I had a 20th anniversary piece on Unbreakable.
Mm-hmm.
And I did a small piece on a Netflix short film called If Anything Happens, I Love You.
Which, oh, yeah.
Anyway.
Intense, I've heard.
Yeah. Anyway, and so, yeah, I was doing a weekly series on Agnes Varda, just mm-hmm. going through her filmography, which I'm thinking I'm going to basically just transfer over to the podcast, mm-hmm. just talking with another person about her films, because really, Agnes Varda is one of the greats.
She is. She's awesome.
She's so lovely. Anyway, and so you can find those articles over on moviebabble.com. I co-hosted two episodes of a podcast over at the Critically Acclaimed Network, which is run by William Bibbiani and Whitney Seibold. I did an episode, 2.5-hour episodes on queer cinema. Mm-hmm. I did a 2.5-hour episode on Quibi, which I'm really sorry that y'all can't go watch Quibi now. Like, it's gone.
Oh, no.
It's dead. Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Uh-huh. No, I mean, there was some.
What a waste of money. What a waste of money.
They lost $2 billion in 6 months. How do you do that? Anyway.
Unreal.
There was it's kind of funny that the best thing that they had on there was something that was made for a budget of literally $0. It was
the Princess Bride thing.
Yeah. Anyway, that is that's such a great film, and no, you can't watch it now.
Yeah, gone. Well, it was a I saw little clips of it. It seemed like a nice little homage. But yeah, okay, cool. So I will make sure to link all of B's links in the bio. Have great film takes on Twitter. I don't think I followed you. I follow you on Letterboxd, but I will.
All right.
And yeah, we both write for Movie Babble, so you can check us both out there. I don't think I've plugged that on the podcast, but
yeah, that's one of the things. It's like, you write stuff, plug your stuff.
I do.
Anyway.
Well, yeah, I do write on Movie Babble. If you want to go check that out, please do. And Movie Babble is great. They also have, you know, a Patreon and stuff if you want to, you know, support some, I think, very good film criticism. But on the podcast side, definitely thank you. You know, thank you, B, for being on. This has been very cool, very interesting, different episode. And to my followers, please make sure to rate and review if you're listening on iTunes. That'd be great. If you're listening on Spotify, make sure you follow, subscribe to the podcast. If you are not, please check out, if you are not a patron, feel free to check out my Patreon. As I was telling B, if you sign up, you get stickers. B, I will be sending you stickers because you were a guest. So definitely check out the Patreon. We also have a Ko-fi page, which the link I'll put in the show notes. So if you you know, don't feel like you can give money monthly, but you still want to support, that's totally cool. And Ko-fi, you know, if you give a buck or two, I'll send you a sticker. Instagram and Twitter, please follow us at Oh No The Pod. And yeah, I think that's all I got.
All right.
Damn. Anyway.
Yeah.
Thank you very much, B. Happy holidays. I am sure we will be chatting more about films soon.
Yeah.
And to my loyal listeners, thank you so much. You know, and hey, have a happy season. Thank you so much to my patrons, Grace Murray, Lindsay, Morgan McCarthy, Alana Coleman, Kira Sears, Jillian Townsend, Schaefer Nelson, Clay Moyhan, Haley Pregnall, and Caroline Phelan. You all are the best, and if you are interested in becoming a patron and receiving a shout out like this at the end of every podcast, please check out the link in the description. Ono's theme song was written, performed, and recorded by Katie Stahl and Mackenzie Haight, and the amazing cover art was done by Devante Burse, at Vante Burse on all socials, at Designed by Devante on Instagram.